Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Today we have three speakers talking about an interesting and provocative and wonderful topic called Natural Wonders of the City, Appreciating and Preserving San Francisco's Wildlands and Wildlife. Ruth Gravanas is a member of the San Francisco Commission on the Environment and one of our speakers today. Margot Boers is a board member of the California Native Plant Society, and Peter Brostow is a founding director of Nature in the City. They will each tell you from their perspective what they have learned and what they would like to accomplish in terms of the wildlands and wildlife in the city. So I'm going to turn this over to Ruth now for her to introduce Ruth and Margot to you, and then we will get on board with our program.
Thank you very much, Anne, and welcome everyone. First, Margot Boers is going to show us some examples of the beauty and wonder of our remaining natural areas, and then Peter Brostow and I will explore what's being done to protect and preserve these areas. Margot.
Thank you, Ruth. My name is Margot Boers. I'm an artist and photographer, and I've lived in San Francisco for about 40 years. And my main subject is the wildflowers and natural areas in San Francisco. So I'd like to show you some pictures of what we have right here. Let's see. Okay, this is from Twin Peaks looking at the city. And you can see we live in a very dense area. In fact, we're one of the most densely populated areas in the country, second only to New York City. But if this fellow taking the picture looked just to the left, this is what he would see. Fields of wildflowers during the right season, and the Golden Gate Bridge in the distance. We're really blessed to have a lot of beautiful natural areas in San Francisco. This picture, I'm going to move very quickly. This picture is just to give you the idea of the diversity that we have in California and in San Francisco. We have everything from mountains to deserts to coastal areas, and tremendous biodiversity here, which is recognized worldwide as a hotspot of biodiversity. Okay, San Francisco alone has over 450 native species. These are some lupins and some bright monkey flowers, and mass bloom. Okay, we are also, San Francisco Bay is also recognized as a wetland ecosystem of very important significance worldwide. It was just officially recognized in February, just last month. So the ecosystems there support over 1,000 species of mammals and birds and reptiles. So we live in a very biodiverse area. Okay, one reason we have so much biodiversity is that we have a lot of nice hilltops that in early days were spared from development. They were either too steep or too remote to develop. And then in later days, people started to appreciate how valuable they were, and the community got together and stopped some of the development on these hilltops. And they're full of wonderful wildflowers and a lot of them beautiful views. This is Grandview Hilltop. And here are a couple of more hilltops that are well known in San Francisco, Twin Peaks and Mount Davidson. Both of them have more than 100 species of wildflowers in each area. And Bernal Heights, another beautiful area that has over 90 species of wildflowers. It's a grassland primarily, and this is what a lot of San Francisco looked like in early days. Now, what I'm going to do is just go through the seasons and show you some of the wildflowers that you're likely to see. Since we're right in the middle of winter, here are some milkmaids and a little fly. The fly looks like something other than a fly. They're good mimics. And some buttercups, which you probably saw on the table outside in the plants that Denise brought. Some Pacific sanicle with a nice red ladybug. pink flowering currant. This is now in full bloom in many of our natural areas, and it's also a wonderful garden plant. I have this plant in my yard, and it's just covered with blossoms, and the bees are just having a field day. So if you have a garden and you don't know what to put there, try native plants. This one is really great. Okay, some shooting stars and star zygodene lily from Bernal Heights. These are both locally getting very rare. Osoberry, also in bloom, in the rose family. And now we're going to move into springtime, and this is columbine, nice red columbine, which is quite rare in San Francisco, but you can still find it in Glen Canyon. And this is Glen Canyon. You can see it's pretty diverse. Being a canyon, it has all kinds of habitats, from rock outcrops to grassland to a river in the bottom of the canyon. And it supports 185 native plant species. It's very diverse, really a wonderful place. Here are some of the species: the checker lily, blue dicks, a little Douglas iris, and behind the Douglas iris is some poison oak, which is one of my favorite plants. So, and I'll tell you why. It provides great habitat for birds. You can see the little bird nest on the left, and on the right you see lots of little white berries. Well, in the middle of winter, like right now or December, the birds don't have a lot to eat, but they love the berries on poison oak. I've seen them in just having a field day. On the lower part of the picture, you can see the berries have been picked clean. Mm-hmm. Okay, now a couple of irises. On the left, Douglas iris. On the right, coast iris. You can see the Douglas iris, the color of the petal goes all the way out to the edge of the leaf, or the petal. And on the coast iris, the edge of the petal has the pencil lines all the way out to the edge. And that little bee asleep in the coast iris is a male bee, and that's because it's a native bee. It's a solitary bee, and the females have a nest in the ground. And at night, the male bees get kicked out, so they have to go find a place to sleep. If you go early in the morning, you're likely to find them asleep in a flower or on a leaf. So it's nice to go early and look around. This is blue-eyed grass, which is a total misnomer. It's actually a yellow-eyed iris. And yarrow and a little jumping spider. If you look closely, you'll see this jumping spider is a hunter, and it's nibbling. I don't know if you can see. It has a little wing that it's nibbling on. It caught a fly or something. So just part of the food chain. Mule ears with a nice bumblebee. Mass bloom of California poppies in the upper part of Glen Canyon. More poppies. And down in the bottom of Glen Canyon is a stream that runs, and along the stream are scarlet monkey flowers that like that wetland area. And if you're lucky, you might see the resident coyote in Glen Canyon. A beautiful animal. I watched it come all the way down the hill. I froze when I saw it, and I happened to have my camera with a long lens. Some checker bloom. And I just want to show you, compare the native bee or any bee with a fly. Flies are great mimics, and here the easiest way to tell the difference is to look at the antennae. The bee has very long antennas, and the fly has very short antennas. But another feature is the bee has two pairs of wings, and the fly just has a single pair of wings. But if you look at the waist area of the fly, there are two little white knobs. That's what the second pair of wings evolved into, and those are called halteres. And they're like stabilizing instruments, and they keep the bee very stable and allow it to move very quickly and to do aerobatics, which is why they're so hard to swat. So anyway, bees are great mimics. This one looks like a wasp or something else. Okay, now some lupin, silver lupin. And this was taken on Twin Peaks, and it's the larval food plant for the Mission Blue butterfly, which you see on the left. And it's being, they're trying to increase the quantity of this lupin on Twin Peaks so that the butterfly will increase. And just a couple of days ago, Lepidopterist Liam O'Brien took a picture on the lower left of the butterfly larvae. So they're coming back, and it looks like it'll be a pretty good restoration project. More lupin and some farewell to spring. This is the end of the summer plants, the spring plants. And now we move into summer and fall with a pink California rose and some California goldenrod. This is locally pretty rare. It's in the aster family, but there's a nice patch of it on Mount Davidson, and there are some volunteers that have been carefully tending this patch to make sure it doesn't disappear. Okay, another aster. The fall time, there are lots of asters. This is gum plant with little green sweat bees. California aster on Bayview Hill, and it's the larval food plant for one of the larval food plants for the field crescent butterfly. Broadleaf aster, another aster on Bayview Hill. This one is fairly rare. This is a picture of Bayview Hill, and on the left you can see the stadium. Unfortunately, in the 1960s, I guess maybe for baseball fans, not unfortunately, but anyway, in the 1960s, the half of Bayview Hill was basically amputated and used as landfill for parking lots and for the stadium area. But fortunately, the other half of the hill survived and is now a natural area for the city, has over 140 species of native plants and beautiful views in all directions. It's a place most people don't visit, but if you have a chance, it's really worthwhile. These are some of the kids from the Bayview area that occasionally visit the hillside, and they are just great kids, and they happen to find this little rare, actually endangered Calentia species that was blooming when they were up there, so I took their picture, and it's just, we're so lucky to have this resource right there in the Bayview area, because these kids can't go to Yosemite. I mean, they do well to get out of their own neighborhood, so to be able to go up to a place like Bayview Hill is just wonderful for them. So, anyway, now I'm going to turn the microphone over to Ruth, who's going to continue and tell you about some of the wonderful places.
I don't know that it matters, but anyway, thank you very much, Margot. So that's just a very, very quick brush of what it is that we are so happy to have here in San Francisco and that we're trying to protect and to preserve. But we cannot take for granted that these wonderful natural areas are still going to be around for our children and our grandchildren, because they are threatened in many, many different ways, and we don't have time to go into them all now. But habitat's been seriously divided up. Rodenticides have been killing our raptors because they are passed on from the rodents to the raptors that eat them. People are feeding wildlife, which also feeds feral animals, which doesn't help at all. And there are some attitudes towards nature. Some people feel nature just doesn't belong in a city. So there are many things that we're up against. But I'm just going to focus on one today, and that's the introduction of invasive exotic species. But first, a little bit more about just what it is that these species are being introduced into, a little bit more about our natural areas. Our natural areas aren't just made up of a bunch of individual elements, a bird here and a caterpillar there and a mushroom there and a flower there. All of these things have relationships to each other. They developed and evolved together over time, adapting to each other and adapting to their physical and their chemical environment. And they are not just things, but they're systems and processes that sustain all of these different creatures. So there's so many things going on in the natural areas that we can't even see unless we have a really great time-lapse camera. But the seeds are germinating, and pollinators are pollinating, and there's predation going on, and death is a part of the whole process, decomposition and recycling of nutrients. These are all part of the systems that we're trying to protect. So we have our earthworms that return our nutrients to where our plants can use them again, bees that are pollinating flowers. I know it's too tiny, you can't really see that orange pollen sac right there on our native bumblebee, but the bee benefits from the nectar, the plant benefits from being pollinated. The spider has just finished wrapping up one of its insect prey and waiting for the next butterfly sitting in its web. And then, of course, there are many, many predators who prey on plants. So what happens when we introduce something from another ecosystem into a system like one of ours? Well, it isn't always a problem. A lot of things are introduced here and they can't survive at all, or they don't spread, or they don't do any harm, and we're not worried about those things. But many plants that are brought here from other parts of the world where we say we have a Mediterranean climate, that's our wet winters and dry summers, seem to be able to get a foothold here. They come without the natural predators that keep them in check in their own native systems, and they come to a system where the critters have not had a chance to develop the defense mechanisms they need to hold their own. Now, a lot of people understand the problems of introducing species, animal species, such as the Burmese python into Florida or the brown snake into Guam in the Philippines, where they do so much damage. It's a little harder to understand how serious invaders plants can be, but many times they have a very serious economic impact, such as this beautiful yellow star thistle, which has really played havoc to farming and grazing, especially in our Central Valley. So again, I want to emphasize there's no such thing as a bad plant. It's just that some plants don't belong in some ecosystems. And I wanted to also emphasize that some people say, well, if you want diversity, that's what you want, right? Biodiversity. So you add one more plant from somewhere else, that just gives you more diversity, right? Well, it does immediately. But in the long term, it sets in motion a process where we end up with a whole lot less diversity, sometimes just a monoculture. Here's a scene in Glen Canyon Park, oak trees, grasslands, coyote bush, scrub. And in the foreground here, you see this newcomer. It looks kind of nice and harmless, adds a little variety. But what we don't see right away is that that plant, Italian thistle, very, very soon takes over, and we get a monoculture of nothing but thistle. Here in the foreground, Cape ivy. What's the problem? Well, the problem is it's capable of completely taking over, and we have large areas where we have nothing but Cape ivy. Little bit of broom, and pretty soon an entire hillside of nothing but broom. Pampas grass is another serious invader. Here we have something called sticky eupatorium on Yerba Buena Island, kind of pretty, but then an entire hillside, nothing but eupatorium. So it isn't just that we exchange diversity for monocultures, but we're also exchanging plants that have great value to our local wildlife, like this beautiful seaside daisy, here being overtaken by ice plant, which has nowhere near the value to our local wildlife as our native indigenous plants do. Here in the middle, the shiny green leaves of the pipe vine struggling against the introduced English ivy and the eucalyptus litter on the ground. This is the only larval food plant of our beautiful pipe vine swallowtail butterfly, which is very rare in San Francisco now. And don't even get me started about this yellow oxalis. Here we have introduced mustard, and in the middle there you see some clarkia just barely struggling with the mustard. Now, mustard's kind of pretty. But where we have had beautiful grasslands dotted with a whole variety of wildflowers, we now have fields and fields of nothing but mustard. And what we've done here is not just gone from diversity to a monoculture. We've exchanged a grassland habitat for another kind of habitat. And so losing habitats is a very sad problem as well. If we want to have biological diversity, we have to have habitat diversity. Because, as the song says, different strokes for different folks. That's one of the basic principles of ecology. So we're very, very lucky that we still have a lot of examples of our remnant habitats. Margo's already talked about some of them. We have our saltwater wetlands, coastal scrub, grasslands, sand dunes, which some people think are just there to be trampled so you can take a picture of your cat. We have many different kinds of scrublands, and we have these beautiful oak woodlands, just to name a few of the habitats that we have and we need to continue to protect. And now Peter's going to talk to us about some of the things that are being done to protect and to restore these habitats.
Before Peter starts, I want to remind our audience on the radio, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, the radio program on natural wonders of the city, appreciating and preserving San Francisco wildlands and wildlife with Margo Boyce, Marco, Peter Brastoff, and Ruth Gravanas. Also want to remind our audience here that I will start coming around and collecting your cards, your question cards. So if you have a question, please write it, and I'll be picking it up. Thanks very much. Peter, you're on.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming. My name is Peter Brastow, and in fact, I am the founding director of Nature in the City, but at the moment, actually, since December 10th, I work at the San Francisco Department of the Environment as the biodiversity coordinator. So this is an official talk of the San Francisco Department of the Environment. You'll see that tagline up on all my slides. And I'm going to be talking about natural areas specifically of recreation and parks, and a little bit more about biodiversity in general. And I'll quickly talk about later in the program about our fledgling program at SFE. So this is just another beautiful example of one of what we have in San Francisco. This is the south side of Yerba Buena Island, and just a beautiful shot and shows another place that most folks don't get to. This is off limits. We got special permission to get to the south side of the island. And that's the California state grass there, purple needle grass in the picture, along with blue dicks and some other wildflowers. And also first, I wanted to just go over some interesting success stories quickly. This is the green-haired streak butterfly. It's not a great success recently over the long term because its habitat has diminished quite a bit. It's endemic to our region, only flies in the Presidio and in the western hills of the city. Nature in the City has created a program to restore the corridor from south to north or north to south, Grandview Park to Hawk Hill in the western part of the city by planting the butterfly's host, for example, the coast buckwheat and its nectar plants throughout the urban environment. And it has been successful. So you get folks together and build some community, plant some local native plants, and voila. We've actually seen the butterfly in a couple of these sites that we've planted over the last few years. This is 15th and Noriega. The butterfly has been photographed at 14th and Pacheco, and we have about 10 sites along the corridor now. So it's been a really inspiring project, and is kind of symbolic of what we're trying to do throughout the city. And this is just a great before and after in the Presidio. This is right near the main post. This is one of many, many dumps that the U.S. Army unfortunately left at the Presidio and that the Presidio Trust is charged with cleaning up. So you can see the top picture after removal of just about all of the Army landfill, the toxic dump. The little Thompson Reach of Tennessee Creek is emerging, and then several years later you can see a very lush and diverse riparian habitat of willows and wax myrtles and blue blossom ceanothus growing along the sides. And just an incredible wildlife habitat, and just upstream from Crissy Field. So I wanted to try to frame a little bit about what is a natural area. You've heard a lot about it already. This, of course, is one of our iconic natural areas, Twin Peaks, looking down on Market Street. And so I wanted to go up to 30,000 feet, or however many feet this is. It's probably more than that. To say that, in fact, San Francisco, of course, was developed in what was previously a wild environment, just like every other place on Earth where people have taken root and built big cities or towns. And so, of course, we have some pieces of our original wild environment left. Obviously, we think of Marin Headlands as a natural area, or San Bruno Mountain, pictured here, and there's the coastal bluffs of the Presidio. The Natural Areas Association, which is a professional organization continent-wide here, they define natural area this way, defined area of natural habitat or ecosystem to preserve biological diversity, and is specifically managed to preserve ecological communities, including rare plants and animals. So, and here's a wonderful artist rendition. This is called The Wild in the City Map, showing San Francisco on the left. In 1750, approximately, so back when we had sort of our Yosemite by the bay, if you will, beautiful, rich, diverse natural landscape of dunes and wetlands and grasslands and woodlands and coastal scrub, and really unimaginably diverse from the perspective of today. But we're lucky that we have a few of these areas left, and you can see those on the map on the right, which is obviously a stark contrast to the one on the left. But it does show that we have a few of these natural areas remaining, which are remnants of the original landscape. And back in the 80s, some local advocates realized that throughout the city, and particularly in the Presidio, where we have, I think, six federally listed plants which grow in the Presidio and are endemic to the region, that there was a huge need to manage these places. And so back in 1983, 1994, the National Park Service created the Presidio Park Stewards Program, which has been one of the most successful community-based restoration programs in the country, really, and is managing all of the natural areas of the Presidio and the larger landscape there for biodiversity. There are many other, several other things going on in the city. The Sutro Stewards are working with UCSF up on Mount Sutro and trying to restore trails there, and the top of the summit has been planted for wonderful wildlife habitat. And there are many other organizations working. LEDGE down, Literacy for Environmental Justice down in the southeast sector of the city has a nursery at Candlestick Park, and some of you are familiar with Heron's Head Park. So there are several organizations and agencies working on taking care of San Francisco's nature. But I wanted to focus in a little bit on recreation and parks. So this is the Nature in the City map, which was about 15 years hence the Wild in the City map, which you just saw. And this map shows a little list on the right there, which you can't read it, but it's just for the purposes of today to show you that we have approximately 49 actually, natural areas on this map. And in reality, there's probably about 60 natural areas within the city, or maybe even more. Pardon me. And 31 of those in the city are managed by the Recreation and Park Department. But there are several dozen others, as I mentioned earlier, which are managed by other agencies. Obviously, the National Park Service and the Presidio Trust up in the Presidio, Fort Funston, Ocean Beach, Land's End, and then state parks at Candlestick Point, State Recreation Area. The San Francisco Water Department, or the PUC, has a few natural areas as well, including, of course, Lake Merced, but also Laguna Honda, and they are just beginning to manage their lands through a lens of biodiversity. So, and sure enough, this is going on all over the world. Chicago has the Chicago Wilderness Program, incredibly well-developed urban biodiversity management program. New York City has a natural areas program. Rio de Janeiro has incredible biodiversity in the city limits. London has a biodiversity strategy, et cetera. And so within the San Francisco General Plan, we actually have an official policy to preserve and protect our significant natural resource areas, the official term, and these are the criteria that determine what is a natural area, whether it's undeveloped, site has rare species, and the site is adjacent to another natural area, and the two together could create a larger and more diverse habitat. And so, of course, here's another beautiful example, Mount Davidson, looking off to Twin Peaks. And so regarding the Recreation and Park Natural Areas Program, which, again, was also created as a result of citizen advocacy for the natural areas sprinkled throughout the city, pretty soon following the advocacy for the Presidio Park Stewards Program out there on the coast, this is a beautiful shot of McLaren Park, which is part of the natural areas section of McLaren Park. And so the Natural Areas Program of Recreation and Parks, among the 3,500 acres, manages about 1,100 acres in 32 parks. And here's another example of a place that is managed by the Natural Areas Program in partnership with the Oak Woodlands Restoration Group. This is Coon Hollow at the northwest corner of Golden Gate Park, 3rd and Fulton, one of my favorite places. These are coastal live oak woodlands, one of the largest remaining coastal live oak woodlands in the city. And an example of a hilltop park. You've seen several pictures of those today. Tank Hill right above Coal Valley and looking out to Corona Heights in the distance. And so the Natural Areas Program does many things, accomplishes many activities on behalf of the native plants and animals and the biodiversity that exists within the areas under their charge, including endangered species habitat restoration here on Twin Peaks. You already saw a picture of the Mission Blue Butterfly. And this is Kira Swinnerton, who works for the Natural Areas Program. They're taking great care of the Mission Blue Butterfly, which population up there has recently been enhanced. So Kira is working with a consulting biologist to make sure that the Mission Blue is doing well, and it has been a successful program with Fish and Wildlife consulted all along, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife consulted all along the way. Of course, the Natural Areas Program has a major focus on invasive plant management. This is in Buena Vista Park, right above Haight Street, removing some invasive ivy and some invasive shrubs from the live oak and toyon woodland that's there. And AmeriCorps, working with the Natural Areas Program, removing wild radish from a grassland. And then, of course, pushing back French broom, which creates a huge impenetrable thickets. And really, it's important to make the note that without the efforts of these agency programs working in collaboration with community volunteers, many of these sites, these natural areas in our city, would actually be impenetrable thickets of invasive weeds, such as French broom and fennel and other plants. And, of course, they also have a huge focus on environmental education. This is at Gray Fox Creek in McLaren Park. And the Natural Areas Program is also works with the Capital Planning Division of Rec and Park to implement the Urban Nature Trails Program due to $5 million in the 2008 park bond and now coming up again, 2012 park bond, which passed thanks to many of you in this room, hopefully, who probably voted for it. We have another $4 million, specifically this time from McLaren and Golden Gate Parks, where there's lots of work to be done. And the most important aspect of what the Natural Areas Program does, of course, is fostering community stewardship. You've seen a lot of pictures of people in nature, and that's really what this is all about, is trying to encourage folks in the city to learn about, become aware of, and then really connect with nature in their neighborhood. And with leadership of the landowners and with certain individuals in the community, such as Rob Bakewell here, who's in the picture and in the audience, we're able to actually foster these locally based community stewardship programs throughout the city, whereby people and nature are mutually benefiting from working together. And I'm going to turn it over to, I think, Ruth now.
Thanks, Peter. I meant to mention earlier that I am a member of the Commission on the Environment, but I'm not wearing that hat today. And I'm a member of many different organizations and recently a group called Friends of Natural Areas. So Peter had wanted to talk about the significant natural resource areas management plan, but I see that we are getting short on time here, so we'll just breeze through some of these very, very quickly. The natural areas plan has many very great goals and objectives and that apply to these areas throughout. It was a long time coming, very long timeline. The process currently is under environmental review, and you can go to the Planning Department's website to get a copy or read a copy of the EIR, the Environmental Impact Report, and we're waiting for the responses and comments to come out. Maybe this summer, we don't really know. So we have this wonderful program in the works, but unfortunately, there are a lot of misunderstandings about it. Some people insist that the program wants to get rid of all of our trees and replace them with sand dunes and grasslands, and that we want to just get rid of non-natives just because they're non-native. And some people say we want to turn back the clock and turn the whole city back into a big sand dune, or we want to block public access and restrict public use. And some people are afraid of thinning of trees. They say that our forests should just be left alone. So people are saying things like the city and UCSF want to destroy our forests, and that's just simply not true. It's part of the charge of the Natural Areas Program to protect and enhance these forests for the longevity of the trees, to increase the wildlife value of these forests, to increase the biological diversity of the city, to increase human enjoyment of these areas. Eucalyptus trees are a special topic of discussion. They are a beautiful tree. They are beautiful to look at. They're part of our historic and cultural legacy, and nobody is trying to get rid of them. Healthy trees are ones with lots of space around them, access to light, nutrients, moisture, and not being crowded together. The owls that nest in the trees and the butterflies that roost in the trees and many of the insects and birds that use the eucalyptus trees don't use these trees, covered with ivy, with a very, very boring understory, crowded together, hardly any horizontal branches. But where they're a little bit thinner and we have a more diverse understory, we support more habitat. Now, just imagine people say, oh, they want to remove 50, 60, 80% of our trees. If you look at this picture and imagine going through and removing every other tree or even two-thirds of these trees or even three-quarters of these trees, you'd still have a lot of trees, and they'd be able to branch out. They'd have a whole lot more foliage. And given that eucalyptus trees often have a diameter of 30 to 60 feet, if they're 30 feet apart, you're still going to have a complete canopy cover. This is the tree that the famous Glen Park great horned owls nest in, one with lots of room. It's true that raptors, like the red-tailed hawk, you can use these trees. They're not dependent on them, but they are dependent on the grasslands where they forage for food. But it isn't an either-or question. We need the grasslands and the scrublands and the forests. Even though these forests are not part of what nature put here, they were put here by people. And when we use the term forest, it's kind of a metaphor because it isn't truly an ecological forest ecosystem. Nevertheless, it's very important, and no one is trying to get rid of them. One of the myths is that we're trying to restrict public access. We're actually trying to make it easier to access our natural areas, turning these almost impassable trails, erosion-prone, into something like stairs that we can all navigate, beautiful new stairs that will soon have wonderful plantings alongside them. Areas that along the creek that get muddy every year are now passable all times of the year, beautiful boardwalk, benches to sit on, interpretive signs, docent-led tours, fences not to keep people out of our natural areas, but just to protect our very sensitive habitats like this riparian corridor. Natural areas, places for wildlife observation, photography, plein air painting. Hiking and exploring these areas is actively encouraged. A thing you might have seen recently in the newspaper, a pull quote that says, native plant programs seem better suited for places like Yosemite than for urban areas. Well, we need to consider, as Margot has already said, that there are many people in San Francisco who have never even seen the ocean, never mind a touch of nature. So it's so important that these opportunities are made available here in San Francisco for our people. Another myth, we remove blue gums just because we don't like them, just because they're non-native. Let me show you one example where the Recreation and Park Department has removed some eucalyptus trees, just some, specifically for enhancement of the stream. Here is the scene before the trees were removed from the stream bed. Now the trees are gone, but there's still plenty of trees in the background. Now you see the water that you couldn't see before because the eucalyptus roots are no longer sucking up so much water. The area is being replanted. And just 1 year after the trees were removed, this is what we have, a very diverse and rich habitat. This was taken just a few days ago. And some people think that this is just a San Francisco thing or a California thing. Let's get rid of the eucalyptus trees. But people need to know that they can be a problem all over the world. This is Wangari Maathai, the Nobel Prize winner, very, very famous throughout the world for her tree planting efforts. She also demanded that eucalyptus trees be removed. And here you see we have trees, but we also have adjacent open areas where plants like this currant can thrive and provide berries for critters. Open areas that give us a much greater diversity of understory. Beautiful plant palette here of the red and yellow columbine and the blue iris and the pink bleeding hearts and the fringy little horsetail ferns. Places for critters who like to bask in the sun. And then, of course, the more insects we have, the more food there is for our insect-eating birds, like this little Phoebe. So now Peter's going to tell us about a new program in San Francisco.
Thanks, Ruth. And it's really handy to be in a kind of Ruth Gravanna sandwich here in our presentation here because she's so good at working on the spot. I ended my previous part of my presentation prematurely, and Ruth just took it upon herself to breeze right through it, which was a good idea since we're 10 minutes to one here. So I have this slide up here to emphasize kind of the contrast between our very precious sensitive natural areas, such as where the Mission Blue Butterfly flies on Twin Peaks in the Lupin habitat, as contrasted with kind of the rest of the city, right? So the Anna Swallowtail Butterfly, which hosts on a native plant called Lomatium, has moved over to a non-native plant, actually a very invasive weed called fennel, and that grows everywhere. So the Anna Swallowtail Butterfly doesn't really need our help at all. But if you plant the right plants in your backyard, hopefully not fennel, hopefully the native plants and some other nectar plants that aren't as weedy as fennel, you will get the Anna Swallowtail Butterfly coming through your yard. And it's one of three of our swallowtails, and they are spectacular to behold. So I just wanted to emphasize that we're very interested and concerned about our natural areas, but we also are fascinated by and very concerned about the biodiversity that lives throughout the city. And so is the state of California. It's nice to know. It's nice to know we have a broader context for talking about and creating policy around biodiversity. And quickly again, we are a biodiversity hotspot, as Margo mentioned earlier in the program. Here we are, number 8 on the map among 5 Mediterranean climates on the globe, which are all hotspots of diversity. And here you see in the lower 48 context, we're only rivaled by the Smoky Mountains. So very high biodiversity in our region, which is called the California Floristic Province, which has a huge number of endemic species. 2/3 of our native plant species here are endemic to the California Floristic Province. They grow nowhere else. So here's our local bioregion, the Franciscan bioregion, which actually includes the Marin Headlands, on down to San Bruno Mountain. You can see there, and the huge wetlands where the airport now is. This is our little biodiversity hotspot, the Franciscan bioregion. And here's a picture of what it used to look like. One of the many, many habitats which were here, as I mentioned, with the Wild in the City map, but are also still here today. These are the sand dunes in the sunset, taken in the late 19th century. And then again, just to emphasize our precious natural areas and how important it is to save these places for plants like the San Francisco Calendula, which is endemic to the region and only grows in Bayview Hill. And then we have a California poppy here. This is the one you'll see all over the state, but this is the one you'll see right along the coast. It's a yellow flower, same species, but with a little orange middle. Excuse me. So critical to think about our local genetic diversity and preserving that. And, of course, again, our wildlife are something that if we don't think intentionally about them, then they blink out as well, like this Pacific chorus frog almost did. There was one last population left of the Pacific chorus frog at the base of Potrero Hill. But thanks to some very enthusiastic and intelligent citizens, this little critter is being spread back again throughout the city in backyards and wet areas. So the Commission on the Environment said, okay, this is really important. So we need to create a program for the whole city. The Natural Areas Program, which I talked about earlier, is just responsible for its 31 areas in the city. So as I said, a subset of our biodiversity that exists in the city. So this is the mission of our new program, to protect, conserve, and restore the biodiversity, habitats, and ecological integrity of San Francisco's natural environment. And as I've said, we're concerned about the whole environment, not just our specific significant natural resource areas. And this is really important, again, because we have all these multiple jurisdictions that own natural areas and open lands, not just the Rec and Park Department. So there's a huge important job to knit all these together and to make sense of them and to make a coherent natural resources management system on the part of the city. You can see 9 different colors here, which signifies, 9 different agencies. And this is just in the Twin Peaks bioregion of the city. Coordination and facilitation, as I just mentioned, working on policy and conservation planning. These are some of the things that I've been working on, trying to insert biodiversity into all the city's planning conversations, including in the recreation open space element of the general plan. We have a great objective that's all about biodiversity, so trying to make sure that's the best it can be. And, of course, promoting education, which is going on throughout the city in many of our natural areas and natural habitats. But there's a huge need to make that consistent and to really bring it forward and to a whole new level to engage all of the public in our wonderful natural heritage using tools such as the Back of the Nature in the City map. And as I said earlier, community stewardship being the most important part of this. This is Yerba Buena Cove on Yerba Buena Island. And folks who live right there on Yerba Buena Island taking care of their local natural habitat. And again, this is the only way these places are going to survive if we can foster locally based community ecological stewardship. Nature needs us now because of all the harm we've done to it. So nature benefits by us taking care of her, and then we benefit by building community and spiritually as well. So thank you very much.
I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum for the Commonwealth Club of California. This is our radio program on natural wonders of the city, appreciating and preserving San Francisco's wild lands and wildlife, with Margo Boers, Peter Brustoff, and Ruth Gravanas. Now is a time for our questions. The Commonwealth Club, I'm sure all of you know, is very interested in what we call informed discussions. And we have a number of cards that are very informed and really do provoke, I think, a discussion among all of us. So it, for me personally, it's always nice to see an audience that really has questions that make us think. Make us think about what we are talking about and what we're doing. So I want to thank the audience for their questions. I may not get to all of your questions, but let's try. Let's try really hard because they're good. For the first one, Peter, that I'm going to ask you to answer because it's addressed to you, is do you have a biodiversity, do you have biodiversity targets that you are trying to hit?
Wow, well, that's a broad question. I'll do my best to answer it.
And you know, in 3 or 4 minutes, we want to get to the question.
I mean, I would say really quickly, the sort of the two main objectives that I see for us is we literally want to secure all of these natural areas and natural habitats, make sure that including we have some private lands, which still have natural value, to make sure those are all secured and managed. And not just left derelict through our or people who live nearby or agencies' lack of understanding or education about them. So, as I said, we have 32 natural areas that are owned by the Rec and Park Department, and they are managing those, but there are many others among this kind of menagerie of other agencies which are not being taken care of right now. So number one is to do that, and number two is to, in concert with that, to ideally, ultimately, have a community stewardship group for every single one of these sites in the city.
This question is very, very interesting. Please describe the forest, in quotes, in native San Francisco, and how many trees, and the author of this question quotes 18,500, will be cut by the Natural Areas Program. Is there wildlife that has adapted to San Francisco forests that will be displaced by removal of non-native trees? Anyone want to tackle that question?
Thank you. Maybe just a part of it. I'm not a really great birder myself, but my friends in the Audubon Society assure me that the greatest bird use of our naturalistic forests is on the edges, not in the middle. And they don't use the dense parts of the forest. So where we're going to be thinning the trees, or in some cases the SIN ramp, the Significant Natural Areas Management Plan, calls for some tree removal so that we can return to some of our grassland habitats, but that won't probably happen for at least 20 years. But the thinning of the trees is going to be of great benefit to the wildlife that uses our naturalistic forests. And the Audubon Society is a great supporter of the Natural Areas Program and certainly would not be supporting it if they felt that there was going to be a detrimental effect to the birds.
There are two questions that are somewhat similar. Again, I want to ask them, even though we've had responses during the talks, and we probably will have more responses, but let me give you both of them. The first one is simply, it's not simple, actually, but it's why knock down trees and use herbicides to make light for more native plants? And the question that's related to this is from our audience, how can the city justify escalating toxic herbicides on plants like yellow buttercups and sweet peas in city parks where small children and pets are likely to be exposed to the sprayed areas? So is that too much? Will that come together for you?
We can take pieces of it.
Great.
That's a bit of a mouthful. And we need to address this because it is a very big issue. And none of us like the idea of using herbicides and pesticides. The herbicides that are used are only used as a last resort where other methods just simply aren't going to work to preserve the heritage that we're trying to preserve. Herbicides are used only under the strict protocols prescribed by the IPM program, the Integrated Pest Management Program, and every effort is taken to protect children, pets, whatever, from exposure. Signs are placed. We understand a lot of people have reported that there's been spraying going on without signs, and then it's turned out that they just thought something was sprayed because the Italian thistle turned brown, and they thought it was because of the spray. They didn't know it was because of the season, or that the buttercups wilted because of the lack of rain, and they thought it was spray when it really wasn't. And I'm sure that there are situations where improvements can be made. There's no doubt about that. But where the forests are going to be thinned, herbicides would only be used painted directly on the cut stumps so that they don't regrow. They're not going to be sprayed. They're not going to be available in the environment. So that's one part of it. Did you want to add something, Peter?
No, I think you did a really good job. And just to note that the IPM program of the Department of the Environment actually is one of the most aggressive in the country. So very, very strict and aggressive protocols for how all city agencies and city employees are allowed to apply herbicides.
And there is a little bit of a question of resources also. The more of you who can get out and join our stewardship work parties, the more of the work can be done by hand and the less any sort of chemicals will be called for.
There are two questions that, again, are somewhat similar. The first one is, please comment on the controversy about remodeling the Sutro Forest, removing trees to plant native flora. And the second one, it has to do with the eucalyptus trees, got it, and the removal of the eucalyptus trees and the impact on the environment. So we have two impacts on the trees in the Sutro Forest and also the eucalyptus trees that are being asked about.
Well, there are a number of myths surrounding the University of California's plan for doing some thinning in the Sutro Forest. For one thing, all that is currently being proposed is a pilot project in a very, very small area, and no decisions about further cutting are going to be made until after that project is evaluated. Those of you who are familiar with CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, know that when you do an environmental impact report, you have to analyze potential impacts of a huge envelope that sort of brackets the possibilities. But because the EIR talks about a huge number of trees, in no way means that that number of trees is proposed to be removed. And again, people tend to look at numbers of trees, they forget to look at percentages of trees, and they forget to look at the very full canopy that's going to be remain when thinning does occur.
I would just add that just like in the Presidio in some places, if tree thinning is fully implemented on Mount Sutro and Mount Davidson, in the case of Reckon Park, the landscape is going to look very similar from a distance, right? So you're still going to see this naturalistic urban forest landscape. It's just that when you get up close, it's actually going to be a lot healthier, and it will look different up close. But from a distance, the eucalyptus landscape that you see in the Presidio or that you see on our two tallest peaks will look very similar.
We are still with trees. This is a question that says, or states, and then asks about, I love the trees in front of the DeYoung Museum. Why worry about non-native plants that are not invasive?
I'll take that one. I don't think, I'm personally not worried about non-native plants that aren't invasive. My thing is, please, let's manage invasive plants, and basically that means non-native invasive plants, for all the reasons that you've heard about today. And when you select to plant things, plant them for not being invasive, but also for having wildlife habitat. So, of course, native plants are great for creating wildlife habitat, but there are also a lot of non-native plants that are great for supporting wildlife habitat. And the third pillar of how I look at this is let's try not to plant the same old, you know, that you see in various kind of corporate lawn fronts of buildings environments. Let's be more creative with our landscaping for wildlife habitat, but also just for aesthetics. So it's not that we're against non-natives, as Ruth mentioned. We just are very concerned about the impact that really a small, very small percentage of them in terms of the number of species have on our native biodiversity.
This truly is an audience that's worried about trees. This question is, which I really honor, and I want to thank you for bringing attention here to all of us about your worries. The palm trees that line Market Street are the host plant for all sorts of beautiful nature that is on Market Street. Are you going to remove them?
I'm not aware of palm trees lining Market Street. The people might have been referring to the London plane tree.
Oh, that's it. I'm sorry. I misread it. The plane tree.
The lepidopterist Liam O'Brien, who I think is here, didn't he make it?
He's here.
Oh, there he is. Okay. Is a great friend of ours, and we're working with Liam to make sure that the habitat for our native tiger swallowtail is not harmed in any kind of tree work on Market Street. We completely agree that the phenomenon of having these swallowtails on Market Street is extremely important to our city, to our biodiversity, to our own cultural needs, and I think I can speak for all of us, we'll be working very, very hard to make sure that the London plane trees remain so we can have those wonderful tigers in our midst.
And speaking of palm trees, the hooded oriole, a beautiful yellow and black bird, now visits San Francisco because of the palm trees, where it did not prior to civilization because there were no palm trees here.
We are back again with trees. I think this is our last tree question. Why should we prefer to have grasslands as opposed to saving trees?
Well, again, this is what I call a false dichotomy, because we need multiple habitats. So we need trees and we need grasslands. We need them both. Here in San Francisco, our grassland heritage has been seriously eroded, and so it's a high priority that we restore grasslands. But as we've already said, for many, many different reasons, our naturalistic forests are extremely important too. And if we don't manage those forests, they are going to sort of sow the seeds of their own destruction. They're reaching the end of their lifespans. They couldn't regenerate anyway because of the dense understory that doesn't allow their seeds to germinate in. And so we absolutely need both. The trick here is to make sure we don't polarize these issues and say which is more important, trees or grass. The issue is, how do we all find the best mosaic of different habitat types to support our city's biodiversity?
Peter? And again, since that was the last question on trees, I'll chime in one last time here. So I'm a fan of planting the right tree in the right place. So you've heard a little bit about that with respect to our natural areas. And that applies to the whole entire city. So there are plenty of locations in our parks and some of our open lands where it's appropriate to plant a non-native tree. There are plenty of opportunities to plant native trees in the city. And in the case of both native and non-native trees, in the urban landscape, in the built environment. So we are all proponents of beefing up, if you will, our urban forest, not only managing the urban forest on Mount Davidson and Mount Sutro, but truly building it out, if you will, in the built environment by planting street trees, ideally for wildlife throughout our streetscapes.
Margo, this is a question for you. Do bioengineered plants have a place in creating and maintaining biodiversity?
Bioengineered plants?
Bioengineered.
Well, I'm not a botanist, so I wonder, would either of you like to tackle that?
Well, it's hard to understand why we're talking about bioengineered plants at all. I would really prefer that we don't see them, certainly not in our natural areas or in surrounding areas where they can spread. Our natural remnants of what was put here by nature years and years before the first human even came are so precious that I don't think we want to be experimenting with it more than we have to.
This is for a quick answer from each of the panelists. I'd like to know what your opinions are. This comes from the audience. Critics have called you derisive names such as naturalists and xenophobes. How do you respond to their concerns, especially at places like Mount Sutro?
One of my favorites is native plant enthusiasts. The native plants were here first.
And we're the newcomers. And I think that, again, what nature gave us is something very special to protect and preserve. And as we tried to show in the one slide with Wangari Maathai, the issue of removing plants from ecosystems where they've been introduced is a worldwide issue. It's not something that just we few crazy San Franciscans are engaged in. And also, as Peter said, cities all over the world have natural areas protection programs. And in some ways, we San Franciscans are a little bit behind in the effort to preserve and restore these areas.
I would define myself basically as a citizen of San Francisco for most of my life, and my primary concern is what's best for San Francisco. And I think preserving these natural areas and the biodiversity here is really crucial. So that's how I would answer that.
Not exactly sure what to add other than, I've noticed for a long, long time, since the mid-90s, actually, when I first came on the scene here, that the term native plant has been kind of, become sort of a pejorative when some people use the phrase native plant. We're not just talking about native plants. We're talking about our natural heritage, our whole entire ecosystem, which Ruth spoke very eloquently about in her part of the presentation. The plants and animals and the fungi, if you will, which is a whole other kingdom of nature. And so just like it's important to preserve the rainforests of Borneo and Burundi and Brazil, right here in San Francisco, we have our own precious natural heritage that we want to take care of. And if we don't try to take care of it, it will go the way of other places in urban contexts where the native natural heritage has been all but obliterated, which it almost has been here in San Francisco, but we're lucky for what we have left, and we think it's important to try to take care of it.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program for our last question and final comments. Our last question actually combines two questions from the audience. The first question, I'll give you both of the questions because they're fairly similar, but not exactly similar. What do you think are effective strategies for broadening San Francisco's awareness and appreciation of the city's biodiversity? And the second question, which is, I think, very connected, if a San Francisco citizen or resident wants to support natural areas in San Francisco, what is the most important thing they can do? And again, I'll refer to each of the speakers for their sense of that. Peter, you want to start?
Sure. This was my last slide. I'm really not on the ball today. But this is what you can do. You can get involved with the Natural Areas Program, with the Youth Stewardship Program of Recreation Park as well, or with various other agencies or organizations. Sorry, what was the first part of the question?
The first part was
awareness.
Strategies for awareness.
Awareness.
Excuse me. Thank you.
Yes.
I tried to put that on my shelf to see it when I put the microphone in front of me, but I forgot. Anyway, so, there are all kinds of ways, obviously, using our digital tools, website, social media, which turns out there's folks in our Department of the Environment that are really, really good at that. So I'm going to be working really hard to broadcast that which is already happening. There's so much great stuff happening. This slide just shows kind of a slice of what is happening. And I'd like to work with everybody in our community and the environmental education programs that are already going on to put unity and coherence to that and really bring it to another level. For example, something that we haven't ever done is working directly with the Visitors Bureau, you know, making sure that we have information about nature in the city at the fingertips of everybody who comes to visit San Francisco, in addition to all of the all of our residents, and having a map of nature in San Francisco in every single household. That would be a great thing too.
Well, my concern is also that education, a lot of education. I think Peter pretty much covered everything, but I'm really concerned about young people and that they get out into the world, they turn off the TV, and they have a place close by that they can go and they can see the natural world. It's just a natural classroom, and they love it. I see the expression on kids' faces. They just light up when they get into the natural world. So I think education, especially young people, is really important. And for everybody, get out there and volunteer. You'll learn an awful lot. I knew very little about the natural world a few years ago, well, more than a few, but I had an exhibit called Wildflowers, and I thought every flower in the crack in the street and everything was a wildflower, and then I started volunteering in natural areas and discovered there are lots of different types of wildflowers. So if you volunteer, a whole new world will open up for you.
Margot has been doing such a fabulous job, very quietly and humbly taking children out to our natural areas. It's so very, very important and somewhat unsung. I think that's fabulous. So I would just say, take a walk in our natural areas. Pick any one of these websites, maybe Nature in the City, which constantly has calendars of walks that you can go on. Go walking by yourself, but walk with the groups that will help you understand what it is that you're seeing, and walk through all the seasons of the year to enjoy the seasonal changes. Thanks.
Our thanks to Margot Boers, Peter Brostoff, and Rita Gavanis, and you, our audience, to everyone here today for a really informed and thoughtful discussion. I very much appreciate it, about natural wonders of the city, wildlands, and wildlife. For those of you who have a copy of our green sheet, we hope you'll be joining us for our programs this spring on new visions in environment and natural resources, the success stories, the things that are prototypes, and what we might build on as we move forward. And again, I thank you. This has been a very informative, thoughtful audience, a wonderful panel, and I have myself learned a lot. So I'm Ann Clark, and this Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years, I'm not that old, but it has been celebrating, of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.